You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello, Grant, if you happen to be listening now or on the podcast. But it's my pleasure to welcome Jason and Summer from Hutchinson Legal. Welcome.
G'day, Alan. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks. And yourself?
Doing very well, thanks.
Summer, don't move your head. It's radio.
Hello, everyone. Summer here.
Righto. Now, Jason, we had a question last month. One of the... I can remember when an incorporation came in because the government of the day, and I can't remember if it was Labor or Liberal, and I don't care, thought that we were turning a bit like America, where we wanted to sue everyone for anything that
yes,
went wrong.
Yes.
And they were very frightened that people on the local football committee, the cricket committee, the arts and crafts, anything like that, were putting their house at risk. And a company director in those days, I know they've changed the rules now, really couldn't be sued because the proprietary limited sort of isolated their goods.
That's right.
I believe it's changed now and directors can be fined personally, or can be sued personally. But the idea of incorporation was to stop it. Now, we've had a question.
Hmm.
Is that a blanket thing, or do you have to be acting responsibly? Because this person said that they're involved with a group and they've moved outside of what they should be doing.
Yep.
They're taking a terrible risk.
Hmm.
And they're not convinced that incorporation would cover them in that instance. Is that true?
Yeah, that's possible. It is very possible. And there are a couple of things to be aware of. So there are a number of different entity structures available, and so sometimes you can have groups. I've seen groups which have been operating for years and actually have some significant budgets and so forth, and they're not actually incorporated at all. They're just an unincorporated association. They're just a group of people. Yeah, that's right. And potentially any one of them or all of them are at risk for anything that the others do. So that's something to be aware of and making sure that there is actually a formal legal structure in place. But you're right. Even if there is an incorporated entity, that doesn't provide blanket protection to the office holders. So there were some amendments to the relevant legislation in about 2014. And as a consequence of those, they brought the duties and obligations of office holders in incorporated associations much more in line with, or not quite in line, but similar to what you would expect for directors. And so as long as you're operating within certain parameters, then yes, there is protection for the office holders and they're not personally liable for the organisation's liabilities. However, if you go outside those, then you can be held personally liable. And there are a couple of things, that there are probably more, but that would include things like allowing the organisation to continue to operate while it's insolvent. And in a corporate sense, you'd call that insolvent trading. You can't have the local footy club continuing to rack up debts, rack up bills, incurring liabilities and leaving suppliers out of pocket with impunity. So you've got those obligations. There are obligations in terms of employee liabilities and employer responsibilities. And so, you know, some of the manslaughter laws which have been brought in to bring in accountability for employers, they would apply. So if you had someone who was killed in the course of their employment, it could be the kindergarten or something like that, where you might have employees, there could be personal liability there. Some of the child safe protections and obligations in terms of reporting abuse of children and guaranteeing oversight and safety of children, some of those are personal responsibilities as well. So some of those things can flow back. It's possible for an organisation to get insurance to cover some of those things. And so if you're looking at getting involved in an organisation and being on the board, that's a question that's worth asking. And it is a serious responsibility, so not one you want to take lightly.
And if you make a decision, it would really have to be based on pretty good facts, wouldn't it? Like, if you're going to commit your organisation to do something, if it's way past what you've ever done before, you need to be pretty careful because you can't guarantee that incorporation isn't going to save you, could you?
That's right. You want to if necessary, you know, get some advice or at least make sure that you've minuted the decision process to get there. The law has changed over the years. In the past, it was a lot more critical that that an organisation have a fixed purpose and that only work towards that purpose. Yep. There's a bit more latitude now for an organisation to grow and change and adapt to different opportunities, different needs and different purposes. So there's a bit of flexibility there, but you want to make sure that you're being very prudent as you make those changes.
Question without notice, which is probably going to be very hard to decide. I've lost my train of thought. I sort of lost my train of thought there. Anyway, look, we'll move on. I've got to take a quick break and we'll be back with more.
My friends, please hear me do. I've got a message just for you.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Jason, I am keen to move on to something else, but one of the things that I should have asked you, you mentioned that everything should be documented, as you know, what they're doing and why and all that. What happens if you're the one person out? If you said, well, I don't want us to do this, so I want my name put down in the minutes that I voted against it.
Yes.
But then if it all goes horribly bad, does that still mean that you could be sued the same as everybody else? If I'm talking about if you walked outside in corporation, like you did something totally silly, but you've said, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Would that save you or would that not save you?
It would probably depend upon the nature of the decision. And so if it was something financial. If it was financial, no, then that would not save you. And so you would have, if the board was about to make a decision that you disagreed with that strongly and it was, you know, related to insolvent trading or something similar, then you would need to resign from that board, I would expect. rather than just sit there and remain. Just because you disagree with the decision of the board does not relieve you of your duties.
No, fair enough.
Yeah.
Now, I'm glad you came in, Jason, because I've had a question.
What a relief. It's better than the alternative.
I've got a question that's been kicking around for a month or two.
Yes.
About a will.
Right.
So you're the will man. I've been waiting for someone to come. Just very briefly, somebody bought a property many years ago.
Right.
Many years. We've had a question like this before, and I can't remember the outcome. So we've had somebody ask, they bought a property down the country, few acres, doesn't matter what the property is, but it's a bit of a getaway. They go weekends and holidays and all that sort of stuff. Don't live there. So the guy has had children, and they've enjoyed going to this property.
Yes.
And now the children are married, and there's grandchildren.
Mm.
The father and the mother are getting quite elderly, and they're going to fall off the perch fairly. You know, not necessarily just in the next couple of years, but they're certainly getting elderly, and they're not going to be here for a long while. Grandchildren are still fairly young.
Yes,
they want to put in their will that they will will the property to their four children.
Yes.
But only on the basis that they cannot sell it until the youngest child is 18 years of age.
Right.
Because they want the grandchildren to have the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, is that legal? And secondly, I can see a problem here. Well, say you've got four children and two of them, I don't know what they are. The third one's you, who's got plenty of money.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth one's me, who's got no money.
Yep.
Now, if that property's let and is left and can't be sold, can you make that? Because I mightn't be able to pay my share of the costs of insurance and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not an uncommon one, and it's a beautiful sentiment, you know, and it's often the case that you'll hear that scenario where the family beach house and everyone's got lots of lovely memories and we want that passed on so future generations can enjoy that. Very common sentiment, but you're right, it potentially falls apart. From a legal perspective and what people can say in their will, there's no trouble with that. As long as some careful thought has gone into the drafting and the arrangements and how it's going to work, there's no reason that you can't say specifically this property is for this purpose for these people to enjoy it in this way. No trouble there. But where it can fall apart is in that situation exactly. You know, if you're selling this property, if it's a property that was purchased many years ago, then you know, there might not be issues with capital gains tax and so forth. But now you're passing on to a next generation. There are other issues of taxation. There's going to be issues of land tax, most likely. Who's going to be paying the rates? Who's going to be contributing? Can people afford to? I have seen family squabbles and family fights even on the issue solely of scheduling. Who gets to book the place for the school holidays? I wanted it for Christmas You guys took it for Easter and I've seen lawyers get involved simply because people couldn't agree on those arrangements. I mean, I have literally heard in the context of these arguments that someone uses all the toilet paper and never replaces it. So it depends on the family sometimes. Yeah. And if the will maker is very confident that the family will get along, And I must say that sometimes will makers' optimism in that regard is a little bit inflated. it can work, but it can be problematic.
I don't want to cut across you, but I guess the other issue is that if there's more than one person involved, the second or third person just may not be able to afford to pay their share.
That's correct. I mean, you could even have an issue where you've left it to the three kids equally and then... So that means that, say, the youngest son, his share of that property is a personal asset. He shares the property with his brother and sister, but he's entitled to a third. If he then goes through a family law proceeding, his personal assets are all up for division. And so do they have to buy him out, or is the place going to have to be sold? Or it can raise problems. So it can be done, but it needs a little bit of thought and discussion before you jump into it. Sometimes it can create more mess and drama than it's worth.
All right, we'll take one more quick break and then we're going to start to cover some other topics.
Sounds good.
Two girls for every
voices, local events. Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Summer, you've sat there and listened to what we've been talking about. It's time for you to talk about. You want to talk about conveyancing.
Yes, I want to talk about conveyancing topic. It's quite a practical one because normally people, you know, sometimes they buy a new house or selling their property, they will need to think about this question. So if there is one thing, only one thing I want to make others to take away today, it would be, you know, always engage your conveyancer and a property lawyer before you enter into the contract to sell. The reason behind this is, you doesn't need to accept all of the terms under that contract sale, and it is very important to understand what you agreeable with under that contract.
So you can vary the contract before you sign it, can you? Or it's up to them to accept it, or you just don't buy.
Well, so to answer the first questions, yes, you can. You definitely can negotiate before entering any contract sale. Yeah. So if you are unhappy with some terms, especially for the special conditions under that contract sale, yes, you can have your property lawyer to help you negotiate with other side's legal representatives. And yes, it's up to them to accept or not your amendments, but anyway, you got a space to negotiate.
Yeah. And of course, what? Wrote on my shirt. But once you've signed, then it's all over, isn't it? You can't negotiate after you've signed.
Yes, that's the point. Like, you know, we all call that one as a magic moment. The magic moment is mean that, you know, after you're signing the contract, all signatures put on that contract sale and vendor statement, and that then you have no space to negotiate anymore.
Yeah. That's fair enough too.
Yeah.
Of course, the exception to that is if there is a cooling off period.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes there is, and you have to be very careful that you know when that starts and when it ends. But with
an auction, there's no cooling off period.
That's exactly right. And so people who don't realise that, they go to auction and they think that they can somehow make this subject to finance or subject to inspections or something else.
Yeah.
No. At auction, the contract you sign is the one that will be enforced. Mm. And that's why it's really important to consider carefully prior to signing the contract. The terms can be negotiated, as some have just said, and it's really important that you understand that. With no disrespect to real estate agents, they just want you to sign, and they'll do whatever they can to put some pressure on you to do it.
You've got to remember that they are being paid by the vendor.
Exactly.
They're not being paid by you.
As lovely as they are, that they're not working for you. That's exactly right. And so they might discourage too much discussion of the terms, but it's really important that you look at them. For example, we came across a matter recently where we were advising the purchaser in relation to a contract of sale, and tucked away in the special conditions was a condition that said that if for any reason settlement was delayed, the purchaser would have to pay the vendor an additional $300 per half hour that they were late in settling. And look, it's very common that you get to settlement day and there's some delay on the bank's part or someone's doing something, and it can be a 10 a.m. settlement doesn't go through till 4:30. You're looking there at $2,000 or thereabouts in penalties.
Jeez, that's a bit stiff.
Yeah. And again, if you hadn't read it or if you presumed you had to accept it, then you'd be stuck with that. But you've got every right to negotiate some of those terms.
All right, we'll take another quick break and be back with more.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson. I'm gonna mess around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
Well, go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your health. Go play your hand, you big talking man. Make a big fool of yourself. Yeah, yeah, go to Jackson. But go comb that.
A snowball, Jackson.
Go ahead and see if I care.
When I breeze into that city, people gonna stoop and bow. All them women gonna make me teach them what they don't know how. I'm going to Jackson. You turn loose of my coat. Cause I'm going to Jackson.
Goodbye, that's all she wrote. They'll laugh at you and Jackson.
I doubt it.
And I'll be dancing on a pony keg. They'll lead you round that town like a scarlet hound. With your tail tucked between your legs. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go to Jackson.
Jackson, ever since the fire went out, go to Jackson, and that's a natural fact. We're gone to Jackson, ain't never coming back. We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Summer, you just want to add on to what we've been talking about the properties, about what people should be looking for in the contracts?
Yeah, that's a good question. So normally we have two parts. We call the sale documents, which includes contract sale and the vendor statement, which is a Section 32 vendor statement. So normally we will just look through if there's anything missing from the vendor statement. For example, we need to look for details on the certificate of title, the zoning of your property, outgoings of your property, and any other material facts. So when we talk about details on the certificate of title, there's one important thing we need to pay attention to, which is we need to ensure the plan of your property is actually matches what the descriptions under the vendor statement, which is very, very important.
Yes, that's right. So very commonly you'll have properties where the titles, where the title boundaries don't match the actual fence lines on the property. And that can mean that sometimes a portion of the land you think you're purchasing is not actually yours. And it can mean that you actually are entitled to more land than is fenced off.
Or less.
It can go both ways. And so there have been many cases where we've dealt with where investors particularly, they've purchased a property or they intend to develop it or build it, and their plans aren't going to work because they don't actually own the land that they think they've just bought. That's a really important thing to look at when you're looking at the titles.
Well, that can make a big difference too, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. I had, sometimes there can be cases, you can look at adverse possession and so forth, but I had one client where it was the difference between, it was only a 30 centimetre strip of land down the side of the property, but it was, for them, it was the difference between subdividing into three or only two.
Which brings the price down.
It's a very big difference, that's right. Yeah. Sometimes with the Section 32s, the things to be looking for are actually the things that are not there. And so that would include if there are swimming pools there and making sure that all the appropriate council requirements have been met. Finding out if there have been works over the value of $1,600.
Yeah.
Which hasn't got a permit.
That's correct. Yeah. Exactly right. Looking for renovations which have been done, which may not have been done with council approval. Yep. And so you want to be looking at the property as it stands, but you also want to look at the documents, and then you want to make sure that the two match and make sure that it all lines up.
And also for pool, swimming pool and spa, it is very important to ensure that you actually have the barriers around that size area, which apply with the local regulations and other relative laws as well.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we're back with more.
Get on board. We gonna ride till there ain't no more. We'll go taking it slow. And Lord, don't you know, I'll have me a time with a poor man's lady. Hitching on a twilight train. Ain't nothing here that I care to take along. Maybe a song. Sing when I want. Don't need to say please to no man for a happy tune. Oh, I love my rosy child. You got the way to make me happy. You and me, we go in style. Crackling rose, your store-bought woman. But you make me sing like a guitar humming. So hang on. The world right. Find us a dream that don't ask no questions. Yeah. Oh,
child. You got the way to make me happy. You and me, we go in style. Cracklin' Rose, your store-bought woman, but you make me sing like a guitar humming. So hang on to me, girl, our song keeps running on. Play it now, play it now, play it now, my baby. Cracklin' Rose, make me a smile. Girl, if it lasts for an hour, well, that's all right, 'cause we got all night. Set the world right. Find us a dream that don't ask no questions.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Grant. And we're talking to both Jason and Summer from Hutchison Legal. Now, we do invite questions, and we've got a question. In fact, two or three. It regards photos.
Photos.
Taking photos.
Yeah, right.
Now, first of all, we'll say you're in the city and no, first of all, you're driving through a country town. You
yes.
see an old house.
Yep.
You think, gee, I'd like a photo of that. So you stop, you take the photo. Legally, we're talking now, not what you should do.
Yeah.
Legally, do you have to go in and knock on the door and ask that person, can you take that photo?
Great question.
Secondly, you're now in another country town and there's a town hall there.
Yep.
So you think, oh, I'd like a photo of that. So you take a photo of that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there are people walking past, so you can't say to people, hey, listen, stop, I want to take this photo.
Yeah.
So you take the photo. Is it illegal to take that photo by those people in it, or is it illegal to show it to people?
Mm.
Now, you're in a country town again. I'm putting in the country, so we're not offending people. You're at the top of the street. You take a photo down the street so you can see all the shops.
Yes.
There's a whole lot of people in those shots.
Yeah.
Again, you can't go up and ask everyone, will they buzz off? You cannot also go up there and ask, well, people aren't going to sign a disclaimer anyway.
Mm.
So how do you cover yourself there? Is it illegal to take the photo? Or is it illegal to show it, or is it none of those?
Yep.
Right. Third question. We're still on photos. A guy goes up to a retirement village, people who are in care. During COVID and since COVID, you turn up, you've got to take a COVID test bill out in, and
yes.
that's fine because people are very vulnerable
sure.
in there.
Yeah.
And then when you used to go in, before you were allowed to get very far, they held the temperature gun at your head
yes.
and showed it.
Right.
Right. This other person turns up, does the COVID test, all right, goes down, and they said, now you stand in front of this thing, and it's on a tripod, and it looks like a mobile phone.
Right.
But actually reads your temperature and takes your photo.
Right.
Now, is that legal to have taken the person's photo? You haven't asked anyone's permission. You've just taken that photo. And secondly, what can they do with that photo?
Yeah.
Because they've making it a condition that you go in. I can understand the test, and this person that rang me can understand the test because, you know, you don't want COVID in there.
Yes.
But when it takes this photo, apparently it takes your temperature as well. And shows it on the photo. I'm not sure what good that is because if COVID turns up 2 days later in the thing, how do they know it was you that went in if your temperature was all right?
Well, that's right.
But are they allowed to keep that photo? How long are they allowed to keep it?
Yeah.
And what have they got to do with it?
Yeah, yeah. Good questions.
Mate, you're
very good questions.
You look a bit, I'm not too sure where this is going to go.
No, and look, I would never preempt the answer anyway. No. So we'll reserve judgment on that one, and I'll leave one of my esteemed colleagues to answer next month.
You'll let them worry about it. Well, actually, there are some quite good questions in that.
Look, there are, and there have been actually some interesting questions of law which came out of the pandemic, you know, and recently we saw a decision of the Queensland Supreme Court saying that some of the Queensland state government's mandates for vaccination for the firefighters and ambulance workers, I think it was, were not valid. You know, there have been a number of legal challenges, and it is an interesting space from a legal perspective as we test sort of, well, what are the permissible limits, and recognising that governments do need limitations around them. We don't want blank checks given to governing authorities in any circumstances.
Which is really, and I'm not here to criticise because I don't run a political program, but it's sort of my understanding, and I think Grant and I did a session on it, I think it was Grant, about the state of emergency, because that gives any government some pretty wide powers, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And at the beginning of the pandemic, when the powers were first used and that legislation was pulled out of the drawer, and for some of us it was almost like, well, we've never actually read what was in this before. No one thought we'd have to use it. And when we looked at it, it was actually quite extreme. The government did change the powers in, I forget the year now, it was probably 2022, I think, now.
Did they? Yeah.
And replaced it with some other legislation or modified it. And the current version is a lot more practical and streamlined and provides some better accountability.
I can remember, and you won't remember this because this is a gap, you're a lot younger than I am, but I can remember there was a big milk strike. And I think it was the tanker drivers were refusing to move the milk.
Right.
They were still milking the cows. They wouldn't pick it up and they wouldn't bring it to Melbourne. And I'm pretty certain the government of the day threatened that they were going to bring in the powers of emergency. And their idea was I think that allowed them to bring in the army to drive the trucks.
Yeah, right.
That they said, well, if you're not going to do it, milk is an emergency thing that we have to do something about. We've got to get the milk down. And I remember them. I'm sure they said, well, I know they did. They threatened to bring in the powers, those powers, and they said then that would automatically allow them to put soldiers in, because soldiers can't strike.
Right, yes.
And they can't refuse to do a job.
Yes.
So they just said, well, I'll drive the trucks whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys are trained truck drivers anyway.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So that was many years ago.
Yeah, yeah. These powers can be used in various circumstances, yeah.
I don't think we ever thought they were going to be used as widely as they were. But anyway.
No, that's right. That's
just
right.
Just quickly, we've got about 8 minutes working from home, Joseph.
Absolutely. So this is another one which has been in the news recently, and probably most likely because the Fair Work Commission is currently reviewing it, because we're hearing chatter of employers and companies wanting people back in the office and back at work.
Yep.
And people equally comfortable at home saying we don't want to go back, or we only want to go back a little
working
bit.
Working in their pyjamas.
Yeah, that's right.
Working down, putting the washing machine on while I'm working. Or
one of the decisions I heard the other day, he was actually a lawyer, and it was found that he was spending some of his time at home playing computer games and listening. What, streaming music and so forth. So,
I hope you didn't hear that, Greg.
Exactly right. And so, look, there's an expectation amongst some that they've got the right to work from home. The state of the law at the moment, and there were some amendments to legislation last year, there is no legal right to work from home right now, unless that was the condition of your employment and that was negotiated as a term of your contract.
Right.
But at the moment, there are certain people who do have the right to request flexible working arrangements. And so pretty much if you've been with the employer for at least 12 months and you can meet one of the categories, like if you're the parent of a school-aged child or you're a carer or you have a disability, or if you're over the age of 55 even,
boy,
they get special benefits. I'm not quite sure.
It's about the only special benefit they get.
If you fit one of the prescribed categories, you can make a written request for a change, for some flexible working arrangements. And the employer has to consider that. They have to give genuine consideration to it, and they have to respond within a fixed period of time. So it's an interesting world. The request can be refused, but it has to be on reasonable business grounds, and they have to have given genuine consideration to it.
Now, I don't want to worry you, but I've just had a text come through to my
here we go
to my watch, and Grant's listening in. So
hi,
I
Grant.
Think you better be careful.
No, that's right.
You better make sure what you're saying is right. Hello, Grant.
Look, the reality with it is that in the world in which we live, from my view, there needs to be a bit of give and take. And the reality is that if there's a employee who's going to be childish, who is playing computer games from home, or like one of the cases, there was an employee of an insurance agency, and they logged that there were extended hours at a time where she just wasn't doing anything on her computer. Clearly, that's inappropriate. And
Jason, just having mentioned that, and I don't want to cut across you, so what right has an employer got then to log into your computer to check that it's not just turned on and just sitting there doing nothing? Does an employer have that right?
I'd have to take that one as a question on notice in terms of the specifics. If you're just a general rule, if the employer's providing the equipment, so it's the employer's computer and so forth, then the work that's done on that should be for the employer. And most of the time in a contract, it'll state that this is for work purposes. In some circumstances, it may be necessary to perhaps disclose some of that surveillance, but there's nothing to say that they can't do it if the proper procedure is followed.
And I'm more talking, pardon me, not so much that the person wastes their time looking up music and all that, but who just turns it on and then goes and wastes
an hour
mowing the lawn.
And there have been cases where that's happened, and the ultimate dismissal of those employees has been upheld by the Fair Work Commission as being appropriate, because the reality is there's no golden egg-laying goose that's just going to magically produce. Realistically, employers need to work with employees to get the best outcomes for the clients and what's going to be in their best interest. Because if you have no clients, no customers, we all work from home permanently. For nothing.
But let's be honest. I mean, the employer is paying you to do a job.
That's precisely
They're
correct.
Not paying you to go out and mow the grass or have a great old time.
Exactly right.
And I just see that it could happen, that you just turn the computer on.
Certainly.
And it shows that it's on. But unless they've got some right of having a check, I mean, it could just stay there for 3 hours and nothing happening.
Correct. I mean, the flip side is also true. Sometimes you have brilliant employees who may be very motivated, very responsible, and can be entirely relied upon to manage their time, manage their schedule, and work that in between school pickups and doing a load of laundry around their tasks and responsibilities. And so if you can foster those relationships of trust and confidence, from my perspective, that's a win-win. For everyone.
I know that I've got a daughter who works from home quite a lot, but sometimes she'll have to do something for the family, but she'll often work till 10 o'clock at night.
Correct.
Because what she can do doesn't have to be done during normal working hours. So I guess the employer's got to, you look in and you say, oh, look, they've wasted that hour, but that you need to take that in context that instead of knocking off at 6 o'clock that night, they might work till 8 o'clock. They might actually work 2 hours, having taken 1 hour.
That's right. And a lot of the feedback we're hearing out of the working from home experiment of the last few years is that for some people, and it's not everyone, but for some people, they are able to be more productive working from home. And so if that's the case, sometimes it's a win.
A win for both.
Yeah, definitely.
Jason, and Simon, unfortunately, our time is fast coming to an end. It goes very quickly.
It does.
Thank you for your attendance. And hello to you, Grant, if you're listening. Thanks for letting them come in again. We always enjoy them. We'll look forward to hearing about the photos, because I think they could be fascinating with all those different, particularly the aged care and all those. So we look forward to somebody lucky person's got to come back and front back next month and tell us what it all means.
That's right.
And, of course, we should just very briefly, because I've got to go, while we're talking about photos, I mean, it's so easy and people take a lot more photos now than they used to.
Oh, definitely. That's right.
You know, if you didn't walk out the front door with a camera, then it didn't happen. But now you can very easily just walk down the street and take a photo and before you know, Bob's your uncle.
No one was taking photos of their dinner when they were buying film at $6 a roll.
All right, thank you for your time.
Thanks.